dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. How appropriate that we are reflecting on the war for the free world at the 18th anniversary of one of its most important episodes. I wouldn't call it a battle exactly. We were attacked for sure, but the fighting that we did at that moment was mostly just fighting to save lives and prevent destruction of property and national spaces. It has been a long 18 years, and one of the people who has thought most clearly and written most articulately about many of the subjects that have arisen or should have arisen in connection with the 9/11 attacks and their perpetrators is our first guest. She is a regular here, I'm very proud to say, at Secure Freedom Radio, Diana West, a great writer of books and columns, thoughtful, intelligent, and extraordinarily impactful in her understanding of, among other things, Sharia supremacism, is what I call it. She was one of the co-authors of the Team B2 report entitled Sharia, the Threat to America, a threat that I fear we still don't properly understand, Diana West, and I invite you to talk a little bit about lessons learned and unlearned. Here we are 18 years after 9/11. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much, Frank, for that introduction. And it's always a day of agony, really, September 11th for Americans. And I would just start by just saying, it's not enough to say never forget, because as you allude to, we have never understood what happened on 9/11. The government is still involved in preventing us from understanding the mechanics of the day, who did what to whom. We're still looking, for example, at a decision that's to be made, I believe, tomorrow by Attorney General Barr on whether to reveal more about the identities of those who tasked the Saudi members of Al-Qaeda who piloted the planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in Pennsylvania. I don't believe he will unmask that, but we will see. However, the larger question that we're still dealing with and still failing to confront, because I think we don't want to confront it, is the fact that 9/11 ushered in a sense, a golden age of Islam. And what I mean by that, I actually wrote a column on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 that it makes this case, and I think it's still true nearly a decade later. In our rush to respond to the 9/11 attacks, our government, our media, our academic institutions, and all the rest of it rushed to accommodate Islam, rushed to apologize for Islam, rushed to separate the Islamic institution of jihad and all that entails, the centuries and centuries of jihad history, from the attacks themselves, which the people who perpetrated them and those who supported them around the world and in the United States absolutely understood and indeed celebrated, and this was jihad against the infidel. We have never understood what that means and how our government, rather than educate the American people, went on in the person of George W. Bush on down to deny that there was any connection between the attacks and Sharia, Islam, jihad, and the resulting institutions of dhimmitude, which we've discussed for many years here, the response of non-Muslims to Islamic law, having to do with this entire cycle that opened up, and indeed we've seen nothing but incursions of Islam in all of our institutions ever since. This is why it is a golden age of Islam.
Let me unpack that just a little bit, Diana West, because one of the things that it seems to me we have especially inadequately understood is that the Sharia supremacists are adept at using techniques other than violent jihad to advance their goal of imposing this doctrine they call Sharia, this political, military, legal, totalitarian system, really, on all of us. And that means subversion. And nobody, I think, really has done a better job than you of helping us understand that there are such things as enemies domestic. And there are people who are working to pursue, with maybe stealthy techniques, jihad, who have, in fact, as you say, penetrated our institutions and helped disable our understanding of their nature and the threat they pose to us, and therefore helped advance this nightmare and assure that we've forgotten and we will not learn properly the lessons of 9/11.
Well, this is, of course, the important piece of it, which is the nonviolent incursions of this totalitarian system, as you say. But even worse than those who are actively working to impose it are those who work hand in glove with them, willingly, knowingly, or not. The useful idiots, which we've seen in other eras, including our own, but certainly in the past, working to appease communism as well. I think that the media, the press, is one of the greatest obstacles to our understanding, because we've seen nothing but Sharia-imposed censorship of the media from 9/11 forward. And one of the other points that I think over these years since 9/11 that I continue to believe is that the face of 9/11 is not really Osama bin Laden's. It is the Kurt Westergaard cartoon, the so-called Bombhead Mohammed cartoon that he drew to show that Denmark was not under Sharia law back in 2005, that American media to this day, Western media to this day, will not permit to appear in print. This became the way the media, the free press in the Western world, accepted the dictates of Sharia, not to criticize Islam, in this case in a form of a mere political cartoon, one of the most obvious and easy and routine expressions of free speech in our society going back centuries.
Diana, we're going to run out of time here. I did just want to ask you quickly, we are marking on this occasion the departure of a man that I personally am a great admirer of. I gather you may not be so much, John Bolton as the National Security Advisor to President Trump. Just a quick sense of where we go from here in terms of U.S. national security policy and what kind of leadership we're going to need in the job of National Security Advisor.
Well, I have long felt that President Trump has not selected key personnel that actually have long believed in his policy of America First. And I would put John Bolton in that category. I did not think it was a good fit for the president's stated agenda that he ran on and won on. And I don't believe he has found that person yet. This is something that is, in my view, plagued his administration from the start. And so, I am just hoping that he picks somebody who has looked at the endless cycle of wars in the Islamic world, for example, that have not prevented the incursions of Sharia and Islamization in the West, but rather have tied us down in the Islamic world.
Thank you, Diana West, so much. Bless you. It's good to talk with you.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we have, again, the privilege of being joined by a man who responded to the 9/11 attacks by taking the fight to the enemy. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He's a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say. He has served in a number of capacities with great distinction, including in the United States Army as both an Army armor officer as well as a judge advocate general. He has been a criminal attorney, assistant attorney general for the state of Washington, but of particular relevance to today, the 18th anniversary of 9/11, is his service for some 20 years as an operations officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. He went on from being a field man to serving as the chief of the CIA's Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. He's also run for Congress, amazingly enough, a man of many parts and a good friend of this show, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Sam, I want to say just, first of all, thank you for being with us, of course, but thank you for all that service to our country, especially in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Tell us a little bit about your experiences in the wake of what happened 18 years ago.
Well, when 9/11 happened, I had actually just come back from the field and was back at headquarters writing a desk, hating life, as any field guy does, and saw the attacks on television, just like everybody else, and probably like half of America, as soon as I saw the second aircraft hit the World Trade Center, knew exactly what was happening, and I think had a pretty good idea who was behind it. So I was actually on a plane very shortly thereafter, headed for Pakistan, and spent the next several months in the field there working a specific plot that unfortunately we still can't discuss the details of, but a very significant plot directed at the United States, even potentially worse than 9/11. So we ran that to ground and put that to bed over the next several months. And then I came back and regrouped to go into Iraq.
These are the times that tried men's souls, as I think the Bard put it. We have witnessed both in the immediate period of 9/11 years and in the years since, Sam, a lot of confusion about who the enemy is, the nature of their enmity towards us, and what the most effective way is to address the threat they represent. Could you just give us quickly your thoughts on all of those topics?
Right. Well, I mean, to me, the key here is resolve, is an understanding that this is not a game that you can just get tired of and say, well, we're going to take the ball and go home, because the enemy is not going to quit. The threat is not going away. As far as we can see out into the future, we're going to be dealing with the consequences of this Islamic extremism that is burning through all of the, you know, the dirty, nasty parts of the world. And so we just have to accept that and grit our teeth and do what is necessary. That does not mean that we can't change tactics. It doesn't mean we can't learn from experience and get better at it. That's not what I'm saying. But it does mean that you can't just say, well, let's sign a peace treaty and quit, because before you know it, you will turn around and find that the war is right back here in our cities if you do that.
Yeah. This brings us, of course, to topic A at the moment, which is, of course, the idea of negotiating with the Taliban some kind of agreement with respect to the future of Afghanistan, the country, of course, from which the 9/11 attacks emanated. Sam, differences about this have prompted, it appears, President Trump to dispense with the services of John Bolton as his national security advisor. It probably had other things at work as well, but clearly there were disagreements between them about the advisability, for example, of having the Taliban come to the United States, to Camp David, no less, to have some kind of meeting with the president and other senior members of his team. Your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I think that the way this often gets presented in the press is as if we have exactly two choices. One is to sign a peace treaty, basically quit and go home. And the other is just to continue to do what we've been doing since about 2002, which I would characterize as having a very large focus on nation building and trying to transform Afghanistan. I don't think that that's not a valid construct in my mind. There are plenty of other options. I think we lost our way in Afghanistan. We began to wander off into what we call transforming Afghanistan into Switzerland and Central Asia. Forget all of that. We have one goal, to leave the place in hands that will guarantee it's not used to our detriment. It doesn't serve as a launching pad. I think we can do that with a much narrower focus and achieve that goal.
We've recently put out, with the help of General Jerry Boykin and General Tom McInerney and Steve Young, who you may know, what we call a secure Afghanistan strategy. And I'd welcome a chance to visit with you about that if you have had a chance to look at it. Let me turn to one other issue that's getting a lot of attention at the moment. Jim Sciutto, who formerly was in the Obama administration, these days is working for ABC News, has promoted a story that suggests that concerns on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency about Donald Trump's handling of classified information prompted the agency to exfiltrate a senior-level Russian official who had been cooperating with the United States, I guess spying for him is the technical term for it. This is now being hotly disputed by not just Trump administration officials, but also the CIA itself. Sam, you were in the business of exfiltrating and infiltrating people on the ground in some very difficult places. Anything you can shed light on in all of this?
For any asset, particularly an asset of sensitivity, I should say, obviously, I have zero knowledge as to whether even this source exists that the press alleges. So I'm not suggesting anything by that. But for any significant source, you are obviously going to have on the books a plan to exfiltrate that individual, get them out and get them away and bring them someplace safe. So that's a standard part of spy business. I think the allegation that this happened because of the president is ridiculous. There appears to be no substance to it. And look, there's a lot of networks around this country that, as far as I can tell, every morning they have a placeholder on their website that just basically says Trump is bad. And then they just make up a different reason to fill in every day. And that happened to be what they decided to fill in on the day that they made this up.
Yeah. I guess the question I'm partly thinking about as I ask you about that is, and we've discussed this in the past, so the point is really to keep this in front of people. The twofold problem, it seems to me, they're kind of different sides of the same coin. On the one hand, the quality of our human intelligence, people like this agent, reportedly, and the quality of our counterintelligence, meaning the ability to contend with other people's human assets and spies in our country. I'm always interested, and I know that this is a very closely held secret by and large, but for the purposes of the rest of us, Sam Faddis, can you give us some sense of whether 18 years after this war began, we are positioned either with respect to our human intelligence assets or our counterintelligence capabilities to contend with the kinds of challenges that we're facing from, well, to start with these Sharia supremacists, to say nothing of, you know, the Chinese and the Russians and others?
Yeah, well, I think, unfortunately, the answer to that question is definitively no, we are not. Which is not to say that there aren't a lot of very dedicated, hardworking people within the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And it's not to suggest that we don't have any sources, but we don't have enough and we don't have them in the right places. And, for the purposes of, speaking in shorthand, why? Because we spend too much time on process and bureaucracy and on trying to run the intelligence business as if it was any other federal agency. And it's not. It's a very tough, sometimes very nasty business. And you need to sort of sharpen the edge on the knife here. And we need to get back to basics and we need to play a lot rougher in this game. Take a cue from the way the Israelis run their operations typically. That's how you're going to have to play to work in this world. We have people that know how to do it. We rarely put them in charge anymore. We put people in charge who have stood next to the flagpole in Washington, D.C. and played political games throughout their careers.
Sam, to some extent, this probably comes down to risk-taking, doesn't it? A willingness, to, as you said, to play hard. You've got to be willing to put people's lives at risk, and obviously that's an all-volunteer mission in most cases, but also to risk failure in trying to run operations or to go up against those who are running operations against you, no?
Without question. And when you talk about risk, let's just really put the fine point on it. What that means is not just that you're going to have to really have yourself a lot of tight and so forth. What it means is that things will, in fact, go wrong, sometimes catastrophically, despite your best efforts. So I'm not suggesting sloppiness or a cavalier attitude, very much to the contrary. But you have to understand, as you would in a combat operation, you will have very bad days and you will take losses. And if you are not prepared to do that, then you cannot play in that game.
And another way of putting it is, if you're not willing to do that, you will have many more bad days and take a lot more losses almost inevitably. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that. I really just want to say, on the occasion of this anniversary, how deeply we all appreciate your own personal service to our country in the aftermath of 9/11, as well as that of so many others with whom you worked, and the countless others who will go unsung, probably despite having rendered real contributions to the security of this country. We need their help, and frankly, that much more of so many others. God bless you, sir. Keep up the good work and come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Giulio Meotti about how some of these forces are now operating against Christianity and Christendom. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, it's a very great privilege to say, by Giulio Meotti. He is a very distinguished and highly regarded journalist in his native Italy, where he writes for one of its daily newspapers, Il Foglio. He is also a weekly columnist for the Arutz Sheva in Israel and a regular contributor to a marvelous online resource, the Gatestone Institute. And of late, he has been addressing himself to a topic of very great concern to me, and I think to growing numbers of us, namely, what is happening to Christians around the world. But before we get into that, I want to sort of set the scene for the forces that are responsible for much of that persecution, not all of it, but much of it, by putting it into a context that's very germane to this particular moment in time. Giulio Meotti, we are, of course, visiting with you on the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks against the United States. I'd invite you to both, if you would, share from the perspective of someone who's deeply committed to the security of the West, and this country, of course, in Italy, your perspective on that day and what flowed from it and where we find ourselves here 18 years on.
We find confused, I think, because after 18 years, we are still fighting this war and against radical Islam and Sharia suprematism. And you mentioned the Christians. A couple of years after the 9/11, when war on terror was declared against Al-Qaeda and all the other jihadists, Christians came under attack all over the world. It's very clear that Christians were one of the first targets of these, not only the United States and the Western democracies and the European capitals, but Christians per se were one of the first group which the jihadists had to cleanse from those areas. Iraq, in fact, is one of the major focus of this persecution. And it has been an ethnic cleansing which was very fruitful from the Islamic point of view, since Mosul, for example, which was the self-declared capital of the Islamic State, had about 20,000 Christians before ISIS came to power. And today, just 40 of them returned to the city, even after the ISIS collapse. So we have to understand that even if ISIS has been defeated militarily on the ground, their strategy has been very, very successful.
Yes. And this is unfortunately not confined to the Middle East. It's particularly evident there where, as you say, the population of Christians has been dramatically reduced and many of them driven out. But talk about what's happening in Europe as well, in Italy, your own country, but more generally with regard to the condition of Christianity and the rising, well, domination, I would argue, of these Sharia adherent, Sharia supremacist Muslims. I'm not talking about, you know, others who are not imbued with this idea that they must rule the world in accordance with Sharia. I'm talking about those who believe that not only is that their God-directed purpose, but that they must use every instrument of their jihad to accomplish it.
Europe is facing an existential crisis right now. It's a perfect storm of demographic aging. Birth rates are falling all over, in Rome, in Spain, in Paris, as in Germany, in UK. Immigration is continuing, not only from the Mediterranean, but also from the legal channels with the so-called reunification of the families. And the numbers are growing and growing. And if you want, we can talk about it. And after, I would say, 2 or 3 years of major terror attacks in Paris, as in London, and all over Europe from ISIS, we are now seeing a kind of now reflux of jihadists are returning to Europe. Counterterrorism is working to dismantle jihadist cells. But the general feeling is that we are not facing and we are not fighting the ideological battle, which from my point of view is the most important one. So we can defeat and destroy the hardware of terrorism, but the software, which is the Islamic ideology, radical Islam, as the world like to say, is still advancing and very, very fast. You can see from the proliferation of Islamic symbols, Sharia courts in London, the enclaves in all the major European cities.
Mm-hmm. The so-called no-go zones in some cases.
So-called no-go zones. It's a mix of areas, abandoned areas.
Yeah. You know, you say that we are not fighting this ideology properly. I'm not even sure that we can say we even understand this ideology. We were talking a little bit about this with Diana West in the first segment, Giulio Miotti. How well, from your perspective, in Europe today, for example, and you might opine on what you think is going on here as well, but particularly from Europe, do you think this threat is properly, you know, calibrated, and therefore we have a basis upon which to respond to it?
We are not facing it. You are right. We didn't even understand the challenge. I think the mainstream, the establishment, the European Union, all those chattering classes, as we can define the media, intellectuals, are not even in the battle. I don't think are even in the battle. I think they understand the challenge, but I think it's too big for them. It's too severe, the threats to really facing. People and the population are really understanding what is going on. You can see from the changing of the political, parliaments are changing, new forces are coming in. But I think the establishment is very, very intelligent in closing the ranks, you know?
Let me just ask you this way. Is it, in your experience, the case that the press is, and the chattering classes, if you will, more broadly, actually part of the problem? In America, I can tell you, we have seen a very active effort on their part to suppress the kind of information we're sharing today. The analysis that we've done at the Center for Security Policy, for example, is endlessly attacked for the purpose of essentially trying to silence us, I believe, by the mainstream press. They'll usually cite, you know, a Muslim Brotherhood front like the Council on American Islamic Relations or the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I suspect you're seeing the same sort of thing there as well. If anything, it's worse because it seems as though it's kind of been codified by the European Union that you will not talk about these sorts of things lest you violate, as we talked about with Diana, Sharia blasphemy restrictions.
Hmm. Here is even worse, because in America you have the First Amendment. It's the land of the free and the brave by now. Here in Europe you have the legal challenges also. You have dozens and dozens of intellectuals, journalists, writers who have been put on trial for raising the alarm or for using the wrong word, wrong according to their vocabulary, or to, I don't know, for Islamophobia, racism, et cetera, et cetera. Dozens of them. In France, it's now a big story. We have a historian like Georges Bensoussan, who was on trial for attacking Muslim anti-Semitism, Alain Finkielkraut, Eric Zemmour, the same Michel Houellebecq, who is the most important French writer, French writer submission. And also in Italy, you have journalists with bodyguards. And so the threat here is even more important and intensive, I think, than America. So yes, the media and the chattering classes are part of the problem, because the wishful blindness is tragic, in my point of view.
Willful blindness here, yeah. Have you experienced this yourself, Giulio?
Some threats, not so severe, but some threats, yes.
Well, thank God, and I hope that will continue to be de minimis. But let me ask you, just to put a fine point on what we started with, as you look at what's happening in Europe today, what is the condition of Christianity there? Is it a source of a focus of persecution effectively as well?
Not a direct persecution. It's more it's becoming irrelevant, which I think is not less dramatic than a direct persecution.
This is a function of the secularization of the society?
Evaporation of the identity. Radical secularization, which is very anti-Christian. The Jewish symbols are disappearing all over our cities. Christian symbols are under attack from the very same elite. Even the Vatican, it's out of the field of battle, because it's now the court word, it's ecumenism, it's the universal religion. The Pope is very involved in this kind of dialogue.
Interfaith dialogue, particularly, and I'm afraid evidencing a lot of submission on his part and that of the church as well. Giulio, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back for a much longer conversation with us sometime soon. Thank you for the work you do at Il Foglio and Aritz Sheva, and of course for the Gatestone Institute. I really commend to all of our listeners your superb writing there, particularly on this problem of what's happening to Western civilization.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to be welcoming as well for the first time to our microphones, Jonathan Feldstein. He is a man who currently lives in Israel. We've caught up with him in Detroit, however. He is the president of an organization, about which we'll ask him in a moment, Run for Zion. He is also a very prolific contributor to the public policy debate on matters involving some of the topics top of mind for us at the moment, specifically the kinds of forces that are operating in this country, among other places, of course, that brought us 9/11 and that have caused so much heartache and grief to the people of Israel, to the people of this country, and countless others around the world as well. Jonathan, it's good to have you with us. Just tell us very quickly what Run for Zion involves.
Sure. So people can get information at runforzion.com. But basically what we're doing is we've provided a Christian experience around the Jerusalem Marathon for people who want to run, walk, or stand on the sidelines and cheer. And we put together an incredible tour package with service projects to give people the opportunity to come over and have a really meaningful interactive experience. And it's one of the most incredible things that I've ever done.
I can only imagine in the spectacular city of Jerusalem, a marathon would be one of the ways to savor that glorious place. Let me ask you, you were in New York on 9/11. You subsequently made Aliyah, as it's called, to Israel. You migrated there. You have a perspective, therefore, on what happened 18 years ago today and what has happened in the years since that I think is important for our audience. Tell us a little bit about your perspectives on what went down, why it went down, and whether we've got a clue as to the nature of its continuing menace to us.
The last question is the most profound, but what went down is just a continued war of Islamists on anyone who's not an Islamist. And we've even seen Islamists fighting one another and killing one another for the hegemony of the different sects within Islam.
Yeah, certainly killing a lot of Muslims who are not necessarily, with the Sharia program.
Right. Well, there's always the conflict between Shia and Sunni. And we believe probably, I think most of the terrorists who committed the terror attack on 9/11 were Sunni, but it really doesn't matter. It's all really part of the same playbook. And tragically, I was just watching something on TV. It's a heart-wrenching day. I remember it vividly. I feel like I want to just weep right now. Like it was, I mean, we all remember this if you have a historical conscience, and it's horrible, horrible day. But we now have longer lines at the airports. And nominal checks of people traveling through all kinds of borders and what have you, or in certain cases not borders. But we've missed the boat. I've termed what's been happening in America in the last 18 years as we've sort of breeding the Trojan horse, because rather than fighting it in our own shores, forget what's going on overseas, fighting it here, preventing it here. We've now doubled down on moral relativism and on intersectionality, horrible words that you have to use in quotes, and just making it so impossible to remember what happened today as the embodiment of pure evil. And it's not the only time, and it's not the last time, and it will continue. But it is an embodiment of pure evil, and the only way to defeat it is to defeat it and not to play games.
It starts with, of course, understanding it. You can't treat a malady without diagnosing it properly. I've come to call it Sharia supremacism. There are other terms for it, but fundamentally, I guess what I'm particularly interested in your thoughts about, Jonathan Feldstein, you have written a lot about, well, this Trojan horse problem, the enemy within, is another way, I guess, of describing it, the sort of stealthy jihadists in our midst and what they are trying to do with different techniques, but to the same end of the triumph of this sort of totalitarian program of theirs, Sharia. You have specifically written of late at unitedwithisrael.org some pieces about Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, two members of Congress, Muslim members of Congress, who have been quite prominent of late, promoting not only some pretty virulently anti-Semitic sentiments, but clearly now the leading edge of the increasingly public face of this Sharia supremacist program now in Congress. Give us a flavor of particularly, having watched this latest saga with them, trying to get to Israel and engage in, sort of a propaganda fest against the Jewish state. How you see what they're doing as kind of illustrative of the larger problem with the enemy within?
It's a great question, Frank. It's illustrative of the larger problem of our enemy within by very virtue of the fact that people like this can get away with what they do and sadly have become the spokespeople for the Democratic Party. And this is not a campaign event, Democrat or Republican, but what a shame that this is now that the Democratic Party can't even call out, ostracize, and even get rid of two women who are virulent anti-Semites. And again, when I mentioned the moral relativism, there was that watered down resolution that the Congress passed with in response to, I think it was Omar and some of the horrific anti-Semitic things she said, but they made it anti everything but anti peanut allergies. It was really, you know, you couldn't get enough anti things in there, and they just missed a few of the really big ones, like the peanut allergy, because we all should be really, and straws. Right, we should be against those both.
It's kind of anti-Semitism too, though I think there was lip service paid to that. That is a problem. But the whole point of the exercise was really, as you say, to sort of divert attention from it. And when you say get rid of, you don't mean obviously dispose of, but you mean, you know, disassociate themselves from this kind of behavior.
The Democrats should have the backbone to run people against them in their own districts. And if they want to keep their districts, let them keep their districts. But put people who are not as overtly hateful in a way that would never ever be allowed. If these women were anti-gay, if they were anti-Asian, if they were anti-Mexican, if they were anti just about any other Catholic, any other religious or ethnic group. Or, God forbid, anti-Muslim. If they were white supremacists who were anti-Muslim sitting in Congress, there would be a tremendous alcohol.
I actually have to quibble with you. I'm not sure that if they were anti-Christian, it would be such a problem.
I said Catholic. I didn't say Christian.
It's a subject we're very focused on here at the moment because it's, of course, a very real problem as well. But your larger point, I think, Jonathan, is indisputable that what the Democratic Party has been doing vis-a-vis these anti-Semites is shocking. And I think the party, as well as these gals, need to be held accountable for it. But it's not just that they're anti-Semitic. It is that is a manifestation, is it not, of this sort of larger ideological bent and the purpose to which they're pursuing it.
100%. You can now find people who have full credibility on the national front, Republicans and Democrats. And by the way, I don't mean to make this a bashing a Democrat day. That's not my point. But these women are Democrats, and the Democratic Party is allowing this. But you can see people for whom it's not a political liability to go have their picture taken and sit on the stage with Louis Farrakhan. Now, if anyone would go and have coffee with David Duke, they would be out. They would, or anyone like that. And this is the problem.
But that would be white supremacism. And that, of course, is the great bane of our time, as we know. And I'm being facetious about that. It's not to say that there aren't, you know, white supremacists like David Duke. But really, I mean, to suggest that that's a bigger problem in America, let alone around the world.
Ah, that's a good point. Correct.
And it's a function, I think, don't you, of this sort of red-green axis, as we call it, of the left's enabling of this. This is what you're talking about really with the Democratic Party. So just to tie this all together, Jonathan Feldstein, we're sitting talking at the moment about 18 years after 9/11 still being, if not clueless, certainly ill-equipped to address the challenge of our time. And that's a mortal peril to the state of Israel, of course, but also I would argue to this country and I think Western civilization more generally.
It is indeed. And by the way, and I have to admit, I'm deeply concerned about the president's recent entrees to the Taliban and to the Iranians. I wrote recently that if he doesn't understand that the Iranians and Taliban are co-equal parts of the problem and they are to be fought and not negotiated with, then he's just taking the play out of the Obama playbook.
Yeah. Jonathan Feldstein, thank you very much for joining us today and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time. Same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.